Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me. My name is Derek Oates. I am the CEO of SmartShift Technologies. I joined SmartShift here, back in September as a general manager, and then moved into the CEO role in the third week of January.
Oh, that's super exciting. Derek, thanks so much for joining us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we talk about your current role and, you know, your current organization, tell us briefly about your backgrounds, your kind of key highlights of your career timeline, so to say.
Sure. So what a ride it's been. So I actually went to school for accounting, and I was a mutual fund accountant for about 15 minutes until I determined that that was not for me in any shape, form, or fashion. Literally, I think 3 months into that, I didn't like it and had resigned to the fact that I was going to go back to construction and being a foreman on a construction crew, because I did not like my job that much. And I thought, it cannot be, you know, as bad as this. I'll go back, I'll be outside. And at the time, this was in the late 90s, my parents said, hey, you got to at least put your resume up on monster.com before you do that. And I said, sure. So long story short, I did that. I ended up going to work for one of the first DSL companies, digital subscriber line companies in Massachusetts, as basically a phone guy. So it's answering the phone, taking first level customer support issues, and then handing off the issues to the network engineers. I did that for about 3 months and realized that I had a very keen interest in technology. And about 3 months into that, I started learning a ton from the network operations people that I worked with. In fact, one of the guys I ended up roommates with, I started to learn about routers and technology, and shortly started studying for the Cisco Certified Network Associate exam. So it was a CCNA. I did that, got Cisco certified, and that's kind of how I ended up, you know, going full force into technology. So I became a network guy and did that for about a year and a half. And I started to notice a trend that I wasn't your typical engineering guy. I like talking to people a lot. And the sales folks at the company where I worked at the time started to realize that too, and started to pull me in front of customers to help present technical aspects of offerings and whatnot. So I moved in into my first official sales job as an inside sales person for MCK Technologies, selling voice over IP gateways, extensions off of phone switches, and leveraging my networking background. Did really well in inside sales and quickly moved into an outside sales role. And that was back in 2002, where I officially became sales oriented. And I've kind of just moved along the way. I was with MCK for a bit. Coming back on a trip from the Midwest, I met a guy on a plane that said, hey, we're looking for technical software people. It was a CRM company at the time. We said, I spent an hour and a half with a guy sitting next to this guy, talking to him about one of my friends potentially hooking him up with this guy who was looking for a solution type of CRM people. And I said, hey, why don't you give me your card? I have somebody I'd like to refer you to. And he flipped it on me and said, I'd like to hire you. Met him on a plane, and that's how I got into software. That was in 2004. I joined a company called Pivotal, and I was a CRM solutions consultant. I did that for a couple of years. And then somebody from my network reached out and said, hey, you're a CRM guy. We're trying to build a CRM practice inside our staffing company. Would you be interested in coming and building up a practice? That was around the 2006 timeframe. I went into that realm to build an SAP CRM practice, not knowing a thing about large scale enterprise and SAP enterprise resource planning software. But that's when I get introduced into SAP and ERP, and that's where I've been working in the context of my career since 2006. I built up an SAP CRM practice, moved into SAP ERP, learned a ton about technology and the stack and enterprise resource planning, which is essentially the software that makes all of the big Fortune 500 companies and mid-market companies run across finance, HR, supply chain, production planning, materials master, all the things that make large companies run typically run some type of ERP, and many of them run SAP. So I did that for a few years. And then in 2009, Oracle came knocking on my door. They were looking for an SAP focused technical sales service architect type of person to help sell Oracle services specifically for SAP application customers that ran on top of the Oracle database. At the time, it was something new. I was interested, and I went and I joined Oracle. I was with them for about 4 years, and was actually responsible for selling services into the strategic customer base of customers running SAP on top of Oracle, and also responsible for some of the technology go-to-market plan for Oracle's engineered system platform called Exadata. So I did that for 4 years, had a good time. Towards the end of that, I started to run into something from SAP called HANA. And HANA was a revolutionary type of technology platform that focused on in-memory database as opposed to disk-based, row-based database. HANA is an in-memory columnar database. All of this basically means that a new business opportunity presented itself. I started to see the impact that SAP HANA was having on longtime Oracle install-based customers in the form of proof of concepts that I was involved with strategic customers at Oracle. I saw HANA being a formidable opponent in that space and decided to kind of stake my career path on the SAP HANA evolution, if you will. So I left Oracle to go to a smaller SAP business partner called Bramasol. Bramasol is a gold service business partner from SAP that the founder of SAP actually owns. Which is interesting. Hasso Plattner owns about 300 different businesses, but he happens to own an SAP Gold Services partner. I went to build up a HANA practice there. And within about 6 months of being there, realized that I was in a position to impact things at a much larger scale. At that point, IBM came and knocking on my door, and they were looking for a HANA practice director in their global business solutions business. I left and I went to IBM. Spent a little time there, realized quickly that there was a bit of a conflict between IBM services and IBM software. IBM was trying to sell their own software. And in my role at IBM, I was responsible for selling software of one of their biggest competitors. So it was a short run with them as an associate partner at IBM that actually introduced me directly to Hasso Plattner through his blog. I met him through his technology blog, struck up a conversation with him, and then he effectively recruited me directly into SAP as a global vice president inside their database and data management group at SAP. So it was kind of like a full circle. I started out learning about SAP in 2006, numerous jumps here and there, kind of shifting my way across my career path and focus, and ended up at SAP being referred into by the founder of SAP, which was a pretty cool thing. Learned a ton, was at SAP for about 4 years. A company by the name of SNP recruited me to become their North American CEO about 2.5 years ago. The interesting part with that was that when I went into SAP in 2015, my charter from Hasso was to basically go in and help drive customer adoption of HANA while focusing on two significant challenges that customers in the space had around the migration path. And one was, what do customers do with custom code? And what do customers do with the actual data migration? And so my recommendation to SAP when I went in there in 2015 was, there's two things you should do. You should acquire SNP and you should acquire SmartShift. And here we are now in 2021, where I was the North American CEO for SNP for 2 years, and now I'm the global CEO for SmartShift. And it's funny how these things kind of mold into each other. I staked myself and my career to really making an impact in this migration space and helping SAP customers move to the greatest and latest platform from an SAP standpoint. And now I'm responsible globally at SmartShift for a very specific piece of the puzzle, if you will, with regards to platform and innovation adoption from an SAP standpoint.
Well, what a journey you got, and appreciate you telling us a little bit more about it. What a quite diverse background. So that leads me to the follow-up question in terms of your current role. You mentioned that you've met somebody also on the plane. I have a very similar story from that perspective. When I first graduated college, that's how my, you know, my career has started as well, meeting somebody on the airplane who turned out to be an actual CEO of ABN AMRO, which is one of the largest Dutch banks. And he was sitting with me in an economy class all the way in the back. So we just try, you know, just we're having casual conversation towards the end of the flight. And just gives me his card and says, come by, swing by and, you know, see me. And yeah, it was just unbelievable. So, and that's pretty exciting to hear what kind of you encountered as well. Tell us a little bit more about your current role, your transition. You mentioned you started as a general manager, I believe, moved into CEO. Sounds like relatively quick transition as well. How did that happen? You know, share some insight there.
Sure. So when I moved into the Smart Shift role, actually, when I left S&P, I had planned on taking some time off. I had been referring customers to Smart Shift since 2012-13 because I believe in the technology and I believe in the platform that Smart Shift provides. When I left S&P, somebody from Smart Shift had reached out to me and said, hey, what's going on? What are you up to? We should talk. That was the current CEO at the time, Seth Henry, who I've known since 2012-13, because he was the guy that I was referring customers to for the longest time. And Seth said, hey, look, I'm going to be moving on. You know, I'm still involved at the board level, but I think, look, if you're interested, I'd like to introduce you to the rest of the board and have you have some discussions here, because I think you're a good fit to come in. You understand what we do, you know, the value that we provide, and you're passionate about it, and you've known about us for a long time, you know, and I'm sure from their perspective, I've got a solid network inside the SAP realm, having worked in it since 2006. And the interesting thing, John, you mentioned you met a guy on a plane and the bank. Networking is everything. Relationships are everything, right? I've sold enterprise application and enterprise innovation at three or four different companies to the same people with different applications and different levels of focus. And you don't do that unless you're passionate about things and unless you've built relationships with people that trust you. If you're willing to buy something of large scale and volume from the same person that's gone to three or four different places, you clearly have a trust in that. And so hearing you say that you kind of went through the same thing, it's not surprising to me, because I find that there's a common thread to a lot of folks that have had success in that realm. It's the network is key in leveraging those relationships, which is kind of funny if you tie that back into how I got introduced to you. Troy Miedema, I've known since 2006, I think. And he's a former Boston guy, or at least Western New England guy. I'm originally from the South Shore of Boston. We hit it off back in 2006 and haven't worked together for a long, long time. But he's just one of those guys that I've always kept in touch with because I genuinely like him and trust him. So again, relationships and networking is everything. So my current role at Smart Shift, I'm responsible for global operations. I'm responsible for delivering value to customers, delivering value to the board. We're a privately held company. We're expertly positioned in an exploding market inside and outside SAP and cloud. We essentially are an automation platform company. So if you look at a lot of the SAP install base that have customers that have done a lot of custom coding specific to their ERP applications, we have an automation platform that allows customers to expedite the code remediation and code cleanup to move from an older version of SAP to a newer version of SAP, all in the context of also moving to the cloud. So we're in a really good position. Automation is key, especially in today's economy, where customers are looking for elements and economies of scale to move away from more of a manual approach to things and leveraging technology and automation and AI and machine learning. Smart Shift has been uniquely positioned in this realm for a long time now. And my job is to help us continue to grow and to leverage the network that I have, not only with the direct SAP customers, but also within the hyperscalers across Google, Amazon, Microsoft, as well as a lot of the large system integrators across IBM, Deloitte, Accenture, DXC, all of these SAP partners that I've been working in kind of concert with over the last, I don't know, 15 years now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's pretty cool. That's very exciting. You based out here in South Florida?
So no, I'm actually in Lake Mary, Florida. I'm in Central Florida.
Central, okay.
we moved down here, let's see, 2 years it'll be now in June. I lived down in South Florida before. When our second child was in the picture, my wife wanted to move home, and I thought it was a good idea. And it was a couple of years that we were back there, and my wife looked at me and said, "Why did we ever leave Florida?" The winters got rough. And so finally, 2 years ago, we decided to move back down to Florida. And I can safely say that it is very unlikely that we will ever leave Florida again. So we're happy to be back here for sure.
Right. No, that's great. Want to spend a little bit of time talking about innovation, something that's, you know, we talk a lot about on the Avi podcast. And from your perspective, as far as building and fostering that culture of innovation within your company, you're not being the CEO, the head. What are some of the strategies that really help you succeed in that space in terms of not only building, but continuously fostering that culture of, you know, experimentation, as I like to call that?
Yeah, and it's absolutely experimentation, right? Because obviously, being relatively new to the company, although I'm not new to SmartShift in general, we have a lot of people that have been here for a long time, and they're great. There's a lot of really strong people. There's an interesting thing, though, coming into any type of change management situation where you're new to the company, where you're trying to get and foster a idea of change and possible growth, and loosen some things up, right? Get people to view things a little bit differently. Get people to understand that there's maybe a little bit further to go in certain areas, and also the ability to open up new areas that potentially could lead to positive results and growth. And so, you know, from an innovation standpoint, we have a few different swim lanes that we are experts in, and we're also growing in some areas, specifically around customers that are looking at building new applications on top of new architectures, right? We work very closely with SAP, and we work with customers that are looking at doing a lot of internal SAP core business optimization, but also looking at potentially modernizing more legacy applications. And what SmartShift is doing and has done has really focused a lot within the SAP realm. And what we're doing also, and what I'm driving, is looking at it from a non-SAP standpoint as well, because we've got a lot of automation capability that's kind of been inside the heart of SmartShift since the beginning, 20 years ago with SmartShift, that was specific to Java and other types of applications that we can now automate the modernization to. So getting people to open their minds and realize that there's other things outside of their specific view of what they know, and understanding that there's growth opportunities elsewhere, is something that I enjoy. And it's something that I have a lot of experience with. And it's really cool to see the light bulb go on with folks once they get a vision and a view of it. It's my job to create the vision, and then it's my job to get people to buy into it. And then it's also my job to make sure that we execute upon the vision. And all of that stuff. That's why I love what I do, because I like the challenges that are presented with that. And I used to be a pretty hardcore technical guy, and I'm still relatively technical, but my role, as it has evolved over the years, it's been more focused on how to build teams, how to get people pulling in the right direction, the same direction. I shouldn't say right direction. I mean, the same direction. How do you bring everybody in, and how do you put, you know, teams together that genuinely want to pull in the same direction, which I believe effectively results in more of a positive and more efficient flow forward.
Right. No, that's absolutely interesting. And in summary, definitely sounds like it's, you know, it starts at the top and almost flipping the org chart and, you know, walking the walk, because you want everyone involved, you know, within the organization involved, to feel empowered, to feel the autonomy that they have the resources and the time to be able to invest into some of these experiments, that they will be considered, that they will be heard. So that's very exciting. With, you know, through pandemic and a lot of things that are happening these days, a lot of companies shifted to virtual, and everyone's, you know, a lot of organizations now, employing this hybrid model as far as the work environment. And I spend a lot of time talking to many executives about this particular topic. And of course, it's very hard to predict what's coming next. But from your standpoint and your research and everything that you had observed through your work or your clients and your network, what are you seeing as far as the next, you know, let's say 6 to 12 months looking like as far as the work setup, whether it comes to, you know, the continuing the fully remote, or anything from that perspective?
Yeah, so we are definitely seeing a lot of customers stick with the remote policy. It's really hard to predict, right? We seem to be coming out of it here in North America a bit, but you know, when we say that, we look across, you know, across the pond, and we see it kind of, the pendulum swinging back in the other direction with regards to COVID and the impact and some of the things that are going on in Germany right now. I have a particular focus in Germany because that's where a significant amount of our resources are. When we some of our biggest customers that we work with are the Procter's and Gamble's, the Jabil's here down in Tampa, the BMW. We've got a large enterprise, a large focus in a lot of these big accounts. And what we're seeing from a lot of these customers is movement forward, but also a cautious approach. I believe Google, who's a partner of ours, I believe they have an instituted policy until the end of the year, at least, that remote work will continue. The interesting piece to that, though, is that we're seeing a lot of customers actually expedite their innovation and their transformation work that's going on. In the beginning of COVID, there was a little bit of a slowdown, and towards the back end of last year, it started to pick up incrementally. And now we're seeing more and more customers move forward with initiatives. From an internal perspective, we're taking a wait and see approach. We still are working remotely. We haven't formally opened up any offices, but I've got my eye on that. We've already got plans of how we're going to do that. We're taking all safety precautions, but we're definitely conservative in nature, and we will definitely be very flexible with whatever. Even if we decide to open offices back up, we probably will have a fully remote work policy and leave it up to employees. Because we're in the tech space, we've had a very flexible policy, much like other tech companies for a long time. Our productivity has actually been really high. One of the things that we take pride in from a business perspective, where it wasn't as much of a hiccup for us, we deliver all of the solutions from a Smart Shift perspective remotely anyway. We're not required to go on site with customers. We do a lot of innovation remotely. We leverage our automation platform from a software perspective. We do a lot of development remotely. We're in a great position to help customers still stay on pace and on time with the innovation initiatives that they have.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's an interesting dynamic, right? And especially depending on the, you know, the relationship with the customer as well, and how, you know, that communication happens. So obviously, there's a great advantage to all of the technology that we have available to be able to interact, you know, virtually. But there's always certain components to that that you can't replace with that interpersonal, you know, face-to-face interaction. So I see a lot of different, you know, very creative ways how companies, you know, employ certain tactics and strategies to complement that. In terms of, so for you as an executive and the top of your company, I'm pretty sure that surrounding yourself with A players, the best people, is at the top of your mind 24/7, whether you are actively recruiting or, you know, just casually having a conversation with somebody, you're always evaluating, is this the, you know, perhaps the right person to join me on my team? I know that I do that all the time. So from your standpoint, share with us any strategies or practical recommendations when it comes to really surrounding yourself with like-minded folks that really bring that missing strength that you don't have on your team. Anything that works well for you, anything maybe that doesn't work and you learn from that. Happy to, you know, hear a little bit more about it.
Sure. So it's definitely a critical element of building teams in any realm, right? So one of the things that I've always kind of tried to do is I've tried to be efficient. And what I mean by that from this perspective is when you're looking at building teams with the right people, there are certain non-negotiables, right? And one of them, obviously, from my perspective, is trust. Another one is effort. And another one is heart, right? And it might sound cliche or high level, but the reality is, you know, you can avoid a lot of headaches and avoid a lot of pain if you keep certain elements in mind from a principal perspective that are non-negotiable. I'll give you a perfect example. You know, through my career, I've been responsible for interviewing many executives, many director level people, consultants. If I spend 30 to 45 minutes with somebody and I can't get them to tell me the simple words of, I don't know, I'm immediately suspect, because I purposely will ask questions when I'm meeting somebody that are relevant to what we're talking about, but I'm looking to find something that they're not certain about. And I'm looking to see if they will be confident enough to tell me, I don't know. Because from my perspective, if you go through a 45 minute to a 1 hour conversation and you find that somebody is not willing and able to open up and be honest and tell you that they don't know, in my mind, there's something a little suspect. And I mean that, right? Because what I'm looking for is people that are open and honest and aren't afraid to say that they don't know. Because oftentimes, whether or not somebody knows something isn't the most important thing. Oftentimes it's, if they don't know, are they resilient enough and resourceful enough to go and actually find out the answer? And not only that, the collateral damage that's done by somebody that don't, that will not tell you they don't know, is a heck of a lot more damage that is likely to be done than if they actually come clean immediately and tell you that they don't know. And so I put a lot of stock in that. And it's one of those things. You know, another principle that I'm always looking for, I'm always looking for people to control the controllables. And what I mean by that is not focus on things that are outside of their control and not spin their wheels, not spin other people's wheels. I look at the opportunity cost to some of these behavior characteristics, and it doesn't make them bad people by any stretch. But when I look at things from a leadership perspective and I look at things from an attainment and results perspective, there's a lot of opportunity cost to not thinking like this and being in that fashion. And so when I look at efficiency and I look at, you know, situations where I'm responsible for delivering results, I wear a lot of hats in my current role and have for a while now. There are certain things that I just don't have the time to focus on. And some of those things revolve around some of the things that I just talked about. I can't, from a leadership perspective, I can't be in a situation, or I try to prevent myself from being in a situation where I have to worry about things like, do I trust this person? Will this person tell me when they need help? If I'm in that situation where I don't know the answers to those questions, I feel like I'm not being as efficient as I possibly could be. So I do the best that I can. Nobody's perfect, but I often encourage leaders that I have in my team. And the way I encourage them is I have a discussion exactly like we just had and explain the ramifications of not taking this approach, and then explain the positive benefits of taking this type of approach.
Right.
I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that's kind of what
absolutely. I love some of these examples. And it's also, you know, one thing that I always keep in mind is I see a lot of teams, a lot of folks interviewing, and more with the focus on what are the different weaknesses that we can tolerate in that particular individual versus really focusing on what is the strength that's missing on our team that we should be, you know, looking for when it comes to identifying a particular candidate. So that's, you know, something within the lines that you were talking about, also making that a two-way street conversation with a potential candidate. So when it comes to the actual interview with you, do you tend to get creative with it? Do you keep it pretty traditional Q&A type of thing? What's give us a glimpse of interview with Derek.
Yeah, I'm not a script guy. I'm not a PowerPoint guy. I'm not a script guy. I mean, I'm not being judgmental, but for me, I'm a more off of the cuff person. I'll go into an interview with a certain set of objectives that I wish to obtain from 30, 45 minutes, hour, however long it is. I don't want to say impromptu or improv, but I will get what I'm looking for from it, but I don't follow a specific script. So I would say that I'm probably not traditional. I leave the traditional aspects up to other members of the team. There are certain things that when I'm talking to somebody, there are certain things that I look at from a job perspective, that I deem that are non-negotiable, and I will hunt to find out if that candidate has those non-negotiables, and I'll find out in strategic ways and feel either good about it or not, and make recommendations that way. And I can tell you many times I've interviewed people for roles where they may not be a fit, but I really like the person. And right on interviews, I will say, look, I don't think this is for you, but I got to tell you, I got two people I want you to talk to at other firms, other companies, because I think based upon what you're telling me and based upon what their need is that I know that you're a fit there. It's a win-win situation. I am not a square peg round hole type of guy, just because I've learned in the past that that's just not for me.
People will remember that on that particular example, that if you took that effort, you know, to be honest, that it's not a fit right now, but here's an opportunity that I'm aware of on the other team. You know, people will never forget that. And it will most likely return back to you in a way that either them coming back and saying, hey, I really appreciated that. And maybe, you know, kind of it's, you know, I always believe in that kind of that good karma, so to say.
It matters. It totally matters. I had a call yesterday, not interview related, but I had a call yesterday with a former colleague at SAP that I haven't spoken to probably in about a year, 9 months or whatever. And we picked up like we had never stopped talking. And he and I talked about it. And I said to him, his name is Jim. I said, Jim, the reason why I think you and I communicate so well is because I think early on, you and I both determined that neither one of us was going to BS about anything. We're straightforward, transparent type of people. And I look at my book of people that I still keep in contact with over the last 15, 20 years, the entire book is built up on people that are no BS type of people. It's straightforward. Like, can I help you? If I can, here's how I can. If I can't, I'm going to tell you. I can honestly tell you, you know, and it, some people say, well, your sales pitch is that you don't have a sales pitch. My sales pitch really is, I will be quick to tell folks, this is what we can do for you. This is what we do. This is our area of expertise. You sound like you're looking for this. You might want to call this person or that person or this company. I can tell you two things that happen. Most of the time, whenever I tell a prospect that, they're surprised that I'm telling them flat out that I can't help them. And two, I can't tell you how many times they've called me back when the time is right, when something has changed, and they remember that I was honest with them. And now there's an opportunity for somebody, either me or somebody else within the company. You only get one chance to make a first impression. And I live by that. And I always try and live by the adage of every decision that I make, I like to be able to say after the fact, wow, I never saw that coming. If it goes the wrong way, I never saw that coming. Mm-hmm. If I don't feel like a decision that I'm about to make doesn't fall into that bucket, I don't move forward. Because that's just the way that it's worked out for me. And that's kind of the way that I have kind of lived and built teams, and it's been successful. Of course, there's bumps in the road everywhere, but it's just kind of a principle. The other thing I would say too is, and I say this to my team and anybody that will listen, you know, I'm pretty loud about what I know, but I'm even louder about what I don't know. Again, because I think a lot of people fail to realize that you can lose your credibility regardless the specific conversation you're having, whether or not it's with a prospect, whether or not it's with somebody you're trying to hire, somebody you're recruiting. You can lose your credibility by talking about things that you're not an expert in very quickly. So,
right. No, absolutely. And that's very interesting from, you know, the whole dynamic and how that conversations usually shape up as part of the interview, and then they continue on as, you know, whatever the outcome is. That's very interesting. And it definitely is the kind of that non-traditional way to interview as well, more with more focus on actual building that relationship. It's a contact sport, right? It's all, you know, who you know that gets you in the door, and what you know keeps you in the door.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, funny, you just ring a bell with that. This goes back to an interview that I did. We had an interview day. I was working with IBM at the time. And my boss at the time was a partner, by the name of Craig Rich, great guy. I'm still friendly with him today. We were doing interviews. I think we were in Denver, and the way that IBM does the interviews is they fly the associate partners and a few of the partners into one location. And then they fly all the candidates in, for interviews for the global services, group. And this guy came in, I don't even remember the guy's name at this point, but the bottom line was we all interviewed this one particular guy and he was a dead on fit and we loved him. Well, we used the same cab company to drive all the candidates back to the airport. And we found out that this guy that everybody loved was really rude to a longtime cabbie that we used. And we found out because the cabbie called one of the partners and said, hey, you're not gonna believe this, but this guy was this, that, whatever. So when we were discussing the feedback of who we were going to hire from that, Craig asked me, you know, Derek, what do you think? What do we do here? I said, well, look, I'm with IBM at the time. I said, well, look, if this is Derek Oates Incorporated, Derek Oates is not hiring this person, because we're seeing who that person is. And this is, you again, if something happens down the road, I will not be able to look in the mirror and say, wow, I never saw that coming. Like, we got a flag here and we didn't hire the guy. And so it is a full contact sport. Sometimes the decisions that you make and the signs that you ignore come back and bite you tenfold. It might be pain because you got to continue your search up front, but the pain that making a decision that you're not comfortable with, especially if you saw something that you ignored, is a lot more excruciating than not moving forward in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty sure you and I can spend probably an entire episode talking about these type of strategies and, you know, the talent acquisition. It's a very loaded and very interesting topic. So I appreciate sharing all the insights from your perspective. And I'm curious, from your standpoint, as far as your content diet, what do you consume on a daily basis? What are your sources for learning? Share with us anything that's very interesting to you, whether that's, a Twitter profile that you follow, where there's a certain blog that you subscribe to and that you have it bookmarked. Curious to hear a little bit more about that.
So I've got a handful of folks that I've worked with in the past 10 years that keep blogs, that are always creating content for LinkedIn. I've got a handful of guys and women that I speak to, and I have basically a blog bookmark list that I keep up to date on within the SAP ecosphere. Part of what we do from a Smart Shift perspective, we focus a lot on companies that are going through mergers and acquisitions. I follow a lot of merger and acquisition chatter and information around technology and changes and change management. There's a lot of online, publications from Gartner, from Forrester, those types of things. The SAP world is big, but when you've been in it for a while, everybody knows everybody. Everybody's got a Rolodex, and it's interesting to get get views on same topics from different people to see how the views vary. It's interesting. So I'd say it's a combination of looking through the Rolodex from a contact perspective, and looking at blogs that people that I've worked with in the past that keep up, and then looking at publications through the Gartners, through the Foresters. Diginomica is a big one, specifically from an SAP perspective. There's different avenues, but that's a significant part of where my focus is. And I still often do read technical white papers, because I'm a technologist at heart, and I gotta keep sharp. Even though it may not be my job specifically to go in and do, a hardcore technical discussion, although I still like to dabble in the enterprise architecture around SAP HANA and relational databases versus columnar and discussions like that. But as I've told people here at SmartShift, look, I can potentially help you with some technical aspects of SAP, but when it comes to the underlying of SmartShift technology and architecture, you know that better than I do. You're going to have to help me get up to speed here with certain things. And they have, and they've been great about that. But yeah, I still read a lot of white papers just to stay focused on some of the innovations that I find interesting. And honestly, outside of the white papers, I spend most of my time reading those.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Reading white papers seems interesting strategy. Depending on, I guess the source, and I'm pretty sure that gets interesting with a lot of, and you mentioned staying up to date with a lot of the different trends and developments, because technology evolves by the hour, and you just have to stay ahead of the curve. So that's very cool. And last but not least, what is one book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
So it's interesting. I would tell you there isn't one particular book, but I'm a hardcore believer in sales methodology. We were talking about this the other day. We were talking about specific sales methodology for our salespeople here globally. And back in 2004, I was introduced to a sales methodology called Miller-Hyman. And Miller-Hyman, I believe it's like gold sheets, green sheets, blue sheets. And basically they were templates that was integrated into the Pivotal software that I used to sell. And it was basically like a boilerplate of like information that anybody trying to sell anything would want to know about their specific prospect. And as you gathered information about these sheets,
hey Derek, hang on. You went mute. Can't hear you. Your sound disappeared.
I would say not any book in particular, but I think all different types of sales methodology. I remember these. I encourage people to our sales folks to pick up different sales methodology books to learn. I've gone through solution selling, Miller-Hyman, all these different types of sales oriented books, because a lot of my specific time is really spent on business development. I'm definitely a sales oriented CEO, a sales oriented leader, a marketing oriented leader. I try and refer people to the sales methodology books that I've learned a lot from in my career. I believe they're critical. I believe that they definitely establish a foundation, and they also help with, they help our sales leaders from an expectation setting perspective. So I don't know if there's any one book in particular, but I've got a handful of sales methodology books that I refer to people to all the time.
No, for sure. And that makes sense, you know, and I'm the same way. I just, you know, have way too many favorites in terms of the books, I guess, depending on the audience, depending on the situation, whatever the case may be. But, you know, it's great to hear as far as kind of you being sales oriented, because at the end of the day, as you know, executives, you either build or you sell. And those that are capable of doing both, those are unicorns, very hard to find. And those are super successful people. But then in the end of the day, that's super cool. Derek, thanks so much for sharing a lot of the great insights with us today. Where do if folks want to connect with you? What's the best way to do that?
My email, I'm on LinkedIn. As I said, my name is Derek Oates. That's OATS. LinkedIn is a great way to get in contact with me. I'm on there quite a bit. That's probably, I would say, the best way.
Awesome. Well, Derek, thanks so much. Looking forward to stay in touch with you. Perhaps we can do another episode maybe in a year to see how much, you know, things have changed. Would love to catch up with you. So I really appreciate your time today.
No, awesome. Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.